Did you get wisdom or did you get only information and knowledge, disconnected bits of knowledge? Because wisdom enables you to organize knowledge and information. And wisdom also gives you an insight into the essence of human life. And it gives you the wisdom to make proper use of the knowledge and power which science gives us. And the boy said, no, I never heard of such a knowledge. I never heard of such a wisdom. And then the father told him, well, you have to learn that knowledge. You need that wisdom. That's the real education. Then the boy requested his own father, please teach me that because I didn't learn that. Then, in a long dialogue, the father tells him, everything in this world is an expression of one divine principle. The entire creation, the entire existence is one reality. The entire human and non-human existence, the whole creation is an expression of one spiritual reality. And that reality is the Supreme Consciousness. It is immanent in all beings, it is transcendent, and also it is omnipresent. It is this knowledge which keeps an enlightened spiritual person away from temptations to make improper use of science and technology, means improper use of other branches of learning. It gives you the wisdom which helps you to make proper use of our knowledge and our power. Now, in this long dialogue, of course, it is a, as I said earlier, the sixth chapter of this text is a very long one. It has got 16 sections. From 8 to 16 sections, 9 sections, the idea of the supreme spiritual philosophy is taught. First, as I said, you know, I already explained this. I already reached, I think, to almost the 13th or 14th section. I shall continue, but I shall just recapitulate, remind you of what I've been teaching earlier. So, we have to think of the analogy. An old, poor man walking through a dense forest gets lost. A group of robbers come and rob him and take him away from the road and leave him in a desolate, deserted place. This is the analogy. And he cries and weeps and makes a lot of noise. Then a kind-hearted passerby, a traveler, listens to his cries and his voice, comes and liberates him from the bondage, because he had been robbed, he had been ill-treated, and he had been tied to a tree with a rope. So this kind-hearted passerby, this traveler, comes, listens to his voice, and unbinds the bondage and liberates him, and then takes him back to the main road, and he says, I am coming from the land of it's called Gandhar Desa. Geographically, it is today's Afghanistan, in fact. So the story is 5,000, 6,000 years old, you have to remember. So I actually belong to that part of the country. I have to go back. I don't know where the robbers have taken me. So please please show me the way back to my homeland. So this kind-hearted person takes him and then shows him the road which leads to the to his homeland. This is the story. Now here, this story is an analogy. It's just in the form of an analogy. This poor man who was robbed and ill-treated by the robbers represents an ordinary human being in this world. And the robbers are senses, our five senses of perception, five senses of action. As I already explained in the last class, every minute our mind is being carried away. Our mind is being dragged into all kinds of sensory pleasures. And then we get lost. So our whole life is spent on acquiring different objects of sensory pleasure. Why? Because the eyes will be attracted towards something and mind also will be dragged towards that. Ears will bring some other objects to the attention of the mind, and the mind will be dragged towards those objects. So all the five senses of perception and five senses of action simultaneously drag our mind towards sensory pleasures. But you know, the sensory pleasures can never give us full satisfaction. When we don't have physical enjoyments, we are anxious to have them. We struggle and we are anxious. We put up a lot of effort. So that is a very miserable experience. And when we get them, then we are anxious not to lose them. And when we lose them, we become miserable. And second point is, physical pleasures, material pleasures, can never be eternal. It gives you a sense of satisfaction, a temporary feeling of happiness. But no sensory pleasure can be eternal. It comes today and it vanishes tomorrow. So the happiness associated with acquiring an object of sensory pleasure is inseparably connected to unhappiness, which is invariable, which is natural when we lose that object of happiness. So it is never eternal happiness. It is a temporary feeling of satisfaction. So every minute, at every moment, our mind is being dragged towards external objects, sensory pleasures. So human life is like a tiny boat that is tossed about in the mighty waves of life. Happiness, unhappiness, anxiety, worry, misery, and so on. Now, there are some people who ask the question, well, I have tried my best, I have acquired money, status, wealth, everything, still I am not happy. You know, according to all philosophers, and this is true of Western and also Eastern philosophers, they agree on one point. Every human being is in search of happiness. Happiness is the one supreme goal which we are all trying to get. So, the ordinary people living in this world work hard to make money, thinking that money will bring eternal happiness. Money is necessary, or status, or any kind of material accomplishments. They have this feeling, it will bring eternal happiness. It will bring eternal satisfaction and peace. Because we are all seeking peace and happiness and satisfaction. All our human efforts are directed towards acquiring happiness. But this happiness that we acquire through empirical objects of pleasure can never be permanent. It's always transitory. But there are some people who dared to ask the question, what is the meaning of human existence? We are all trying to get all this, but then there is no end to this. There are philosophers among them, there are literary geniuses, see all the great musicians, all great thinkers, even scientists, who have spent their whole lifetime and energy towards in thinking of the external nature, were always trying to discover the mysteries, the secrets of nature. But there are some rare human beings who step outside this instinctive flow of evolution and ask the question, what's the meaning of human life? In fact, that is the beginning of philosophy. All philosophy begins here. Philosophy begins where physics ends, where science ends. Philosophy is the only branch which dares to ask the question, why? Science only solves the problem of how, but philosophy is the only area of learning which asks the question, why? So therefore, what happens? Such people try to seek a higher knowledge, higher wisdom. And when you make a sincere effort, you always find some answer. Now, you come back to the analogy. The poor man who was robbed, who was taken away from his main road as he was returning to his home. The robbers who took him away, who dragged him away from this main track, are like the five senses of perception, five senses of action, which bind him to this world. And this poor man who cries and weeps and makes a lot of noise is a spiritual seeker who may be attending a lecture on spiritual subjects, may be going to a place of worship to pray, may be reading a holy book, a mystical work, may be starting to take interest in mystical ideas, some kind of transcendental ideas. So when you try to step outside this instinctive flow of evolution and try to make some effort to find solution at a higher transcendental level, you are making a lot of noise. The robbers have left him there in the desolate area. If he keeps quiet and if he goes to sleep, then the kind-hearted traveler won't listen to his voice. He has to make a lot of noise. So similarly, we have to pray, we have to read holy books, we have to contemplate, we have to think of some higher transcendental ideas. Then suddenly we find the doors are opened. Just as the poor man draws the attention of the kind-hearted traveler when he starts crying and weeping. And then the traveler comes to him, who takes him back to his native place. Now the story continues. The traveler tells him, now you can follow this track that will take you back home. But you have, at every stage you may have to ask somebody, which way, which road leads to my homeland, my native place. So you have to make your own effort. Last time I referred to the synthesis of grace and human effort, and I drew some analogies and illustrations. So I won't repeat right now. Now, this spiritual seeker has to make his own effort. He has to read sacred books. He has to listen to his spiritual ideas. He has to think and contemplate. And then he will get back to his own spiritual homeland. This is the story. Now, coming to the next. At the next stage, this boy, who after listening to this particular story, asks another question. What happens to a person who dies? Is liberation possible in this life or next life? Now here we have to remember, in Vedanta we do not believe in straight line progression. Vedanta teaches you that life is not just a single track movement. According to our actions and karmas, we are reborn, and we can continue the where we have left in this life. You know, as I mentioned some time back, in the Gita there is a section in the 6th chapter where Arjuna, after listening to a long discussion on spiritual science, realization of God, spiritual enlightenment, puts one question to Krishna, the teacher. Suppose you make a lot of effort to get spiritual enlightenment in this life, but you don't succeed. You die before you reach your goal. Or you have a deviation sometimes. People sometimes deviate from spiritual track and you die. Does it mean that you will go to hell? Eternal damnation? Or is there any alternative path? No, Krishna tells him, the teacher tells him, no. Whatever little spiritual effort that you make in this life will not be lost. Even if you read a sacred book for 1 hour, half an hour in this life, if you pray and contemplate on the ultimate reality for a minute, if you do something without any selfish desire, any kind of service, any kind of good conduct that you do in this world, any good action, good deed that you do, any noble thought that comes to your mind in a flash, none of these things will be lost once for all. They will bear fruits. That is one important principle you have to remember. So, Krishna says, even a little bit of spiritual practice, if you meditate a little, and then if you forget, it will not be wasted. You will be in the next life, when you get a chance to come in contact with such spiritual ideas, you will have a kind of rehearsal of what you have done in this life. Again, you will remember. That's why people sometimes, you know, when they read spiritual books, suddenly they get some special attraction. They feel because they have done something, if not in this life, in the previous life or sometime in the past. So they have already acquired certain characteristics which are dormant, like a lake, you know, which is the bottom of the lake. So in this life, when you get an opportunity, suddenly they connect each other. And then you continue your spiritual efforts in this life. Now, the answer given by the teacher is this. So Nachiketa, the Shweta Ketu, the student, the son, the disciple, puts a question. What about death? Is liberation something that happens in this life itself, or is it something that happens later in future? Now, here the father's answer is, if a spiritual seeker really achieves his spiritual enlightenment in this life itself, he can certainly get out of this cycle of life and death, this cycle of existence. Life, death, rebirth, and goes on. But on the other hand, if he has done a lot of spiritual practices, and if he dies before getting complete spiritual freedom, then what happens? In the next life, he can continue his spiritual efforts, and that will take him further beyond. This is the answer given. So, the father tells him, if you try your best to achieve spiritual freedom in this life itself, then you have no rebirth. You come out of this cycle of life and death, what is called samsara. the cyclic transmigratory existence. But if you die without or before getting liberation, then you will be able to continue your effort in the next life. Now, here we have to remember, in Vedantic tradition, spiritual freedom or enlightenment is not actually something that comes from outside. It is not something that you acquire. See, this could be said even modern with regard to scientific discoveries also. Long before Newton discovered the theory of gravitation, it was already there. Newton's effort made the nature, external nature, to reveal it. So even all the material scientists, all the material scientific discoveries are already existing before they are discovered. They are exposed to the outside world by the efforts of some seekers in the field of spiritual science, material science. That is true in spiritual science also. So liberation or freedom is already ours. What we do, what we are doing through spiritual efforts, is to remove the wrong notion that liberation should come from outside. When we are seeking liberation, we think we are bound. So the wrong notion that we are bound is removed through spiritual practices. And then we come to realize that we are already free. The sense of freedom doesn't come from outside, it is already within. Now, this is possible this attainment of freedom is possible through certain spiritual disciplines. I will give an example here. You know, sometimes some of you, when you read a book on philosophy, Vedanta, which tells you you are already free, you are already Brahman, you tattvamasi, you know. See, for example, here this father tells this son, tattvamasi, you are already that Brahman, you are already that Atman. You will think, then what is there for us to do? We are already Brahman. The question arises, if the knowledge of Brahman is a result of your effort, then it is not eternal, because anything that you acquire through human effort cannot be eternal. Anything that you acquire through human effort, something which comes into existence as a result of your effort, cannot be eternal. On the other hand, if you say it is not a result of your action, you are already free before you knew you are free, then why should we work? The question arises. Now, Vedantin's answer is this. Right now, we know that we are free, we are Atman, we are the consciousness, but that is only an intellectual conviction. An intellectual conviction. It has not reached the level of mind. And all of us live not at the level of intellect, but at the level of mind. All of us, if you can imagine. When we read a great book, a spiritual book, suddenly our intellect is attracted by that. And we are drawn towards it. Then sometimes we delude ourselves into the notion that it has become a real experience to us. But actually it has not become an experience. Sometimes this happens. You read any great book, especially Vedantic books, right? Vedanta tells you that you are Brahman, you are the all-pervading consciousness. We are not this body, we are not the psychophysical mechanism, we are the immanent, omnipresent reality, the supreme consciousness. That's what Vedanta teaches. Now, in that case, why are we not aware of it? Or what is the benefit of, what is the use of, what is the practical significance of discussions, reading, meditation, contemplation, and all the spiritual practices? That is what we are going to discuss now. Now, when we listen to these ideas, when we read a great book, spiritual book, these ideas come to us as intellectual ideas, spiritual ideas, intellectual convictions. We may be fully convinced. But then, intellectual conviction is not the level at in which we live our normal life. It's the mental emotions, the mental vibrations that actually determine how we live, how we think. This is a point to be remembered. So there is always a a gap between intellect and mind. Intellect has grasped this wonderful spiritual idea, but mind is still far behind. Now all spiritual practices are meant to bridge the gap between the mind and intellect. What you have, your mind should be brought up to the level of the ideas that your intellect has grasped. And all spiritual practices are meant for this. So in Vedanta, there are four important spiritual practices prescribed for this. One set of spiritual practices are called Sadhana Chatushtayam, four important disciplines. We must have a strong desire for transcendental spiritual enlightenment, spiritual evolution, spiritual unfoldment. Based on that, we must have a sense of discrimination, a strong sense, a discerning mind that decides what is real, what is eternal, and what is unreal, what is non-eternal. And then we must have, no desire for any kind of either material pleasures in this world or the next, no attachment towards anything. Again, we must have perfect control in our senses and mind. As I already said earlier, Iha Mutra Phalabhoga Viraga and Samadhi Sukha Sambhati, etc. I already mentioned earlier. First, the basis is a strong desire for spiritual liberation. And based on that, we must have a strong discerning mind to know what is eternal, and a strong attachment towards eternal spiritual ideas and an aversion towards non-eternal empirical things. And then absolutely no desire or attachment towards pleasures in this life or the next life, and complete sense control. This is one set of discipline. Another set of discipline you find in yoga, Yoga Sutra, very practical. That's also very practical. That's called, you know, non-violence, without any aversion, without any hatred towards anybody. Now, these practices will take our mind towards the stage where intellect has grasped the highest spiritual idea. Very often, you know, people become agnostics or unbelievers. You read a very wonderful book on Vedanta, highest philosophy, and you see it is something really wonderful. But then when you come out of the lecture hall, or when you confront realities of everyday life, you find so much of conflict between the realities of empirical life in this world and the highest spiritual ideas that we read. So what happens? There is a gap formed between mind and intellect. So the practice of these disciplines help us to develop a connecting bridge between mental and intellectual level. So one is, I already explained, the other set is non-violence, truthfulness, absolutely no greed, purity of life, and then non-covetousness, perfect satisfaction, no desire for anything, concentration, and then inner contentment, and a complete resignation to the higher reality. These are some of the disciplines that help us to bridge the gap between the mind and intellect. Now, one great warning that is often given in our spiritual text is, we can never get a full satisfactory answer on these spiritual ideas at the level of intellect, because direct perception and inference are enough to explain and understand things at the empirical level. But about spiritual ideas, we need to depend upon a higher source of knowledge and truth. This you find in one of the famous books of Vedanta, which is called Kathopanishad. I shall explain this also in the form of a story. The story is that of a small boy, Nachiketa. You can find three levels of human spiritual evolution. How one can ascend to the highest level of spiritual perfection. The story comes in the Kathopanishad, which is in the Yajurveda. I shall explain it in a few minutes. Then we have a detailed interaction. We started a bit late. One day, a small boy noticed that his father was performing a great religious ritual, but he was not doing it properly. He was supposed to give away his cows, all his assets, to the deserving people around. But instead of giving good cows, the father was giving away only old cows which can't eat grass, which can't give milk. So the little boy got upset. Father is actually deceiving himself, deceiving others. So he went and asked the old man, his father, "Well, whom are you going to give me? There is a reason for it. In ancient times, son, an obedient, well-behaved son was supposed to be the most precious wealth of family. You know, children are supposed to be. He had only one son. If you are going to give away all that you belong, that you have got, then you should give me also, because according to the tradition, the old Vedic tradition, a father considers his son, his eldest son. If you had only one son, only one child, he has the most precious wealth. In fact, the boy was perhaps very small in his own, as a prank, as a child's play, he went and asked this question. The father got angry when the child repeated this question again and again. The father said, "I'm going to give you to the Lord of Death." Means, I'm going to send you to the place where people go after death. Now, the boy was very sincere. He didn't want to create the impression that his father tells things which he was not going to practice. So he decided to go to the palace of the Lord of Death. The story is a mythological story. He reached there. Lord of Death was away. His name was Yama. When he reached the palace, the place of the Lord of Death, he had already left the place. And he returned only the third day. And the boy waited for 3 days without food and water, hungry and thirsty. So the third day, the man, the Lord of Death, returned home. And he was very, very much upset when he found a small little boy was waiting for him without food and water, hungry and thirsty. So as a compensation, he asked the boy, "You can ask for 3 boons. Whatever you ask, I can give you. You can ask 3 times, you can ask whatever you want. 3 boons I give you, you can ask whatever you want." So the first question that boy asked was, "When I go back to my home, my father should not scold me, should not be angry with me." This represents the first stage of human evolution. We all want to live a happy life in this world. Everything, all the physical comfort satisfied, all material needs satisfied. This first stage of human evolution, natural stage of human evolution, you find. Now, the second question, the second boon which the boy asked was, after my death, I should go to heaven. This is also natural. Because, you know, this is natural evolution in human life. The most primitive person lives that the present, that whatever he sees in the present is the only reality. He can never think of anything beyond what he sees in front of him. He can never see or think of anything beyond what he experiences around him, the immediate surroundings. That's the nature of the most primitive person. But in all monotheistic religions, in all ancient civilizations, there is this idea that life in this world is not always perfect. There is something beyond what we can experience in this life. So we always think of death, and death poses a number of questions. What happens to us after death? What's the meaning of death? So people naturally think of heaven and hell, and they visualize that life in hell is terrible, so they would like to go to heaven. So the boy asked the Lord of Death, please grant me that I would go to heaven after my death, so that I can enjoy that. Now, up to this level, human aspirations are universal everywhere. But this boy goes one step beyond. The third boon he asks, now, you have given me a long life in this world. You have granted me heaven. But according to Vedantic tradition, oriental tradition, heaven is not an eternal experience. Heaven is the result of your good deeds done in this world. If you do a lot of meritorious deeds, you go to heaven. You can enjoy the result of good deeds done in this life. But then, once the results of your good deeds in this life are exhausted, then you have to go away from heaven, come back to earth, and be born as a human being. So Nachiketa asked a question. There are different views as to what happens to us when we go to heaven. Some people say that after death, everything is over. Death is just a one-way traffic. You go, and at the end of this life, you get eternal damnation, or you get admitted to heaven. Now, just imagine the plight of people who are told that they will go to eternal damnation, you know. You have done something wrong. But Vedanta tells you, it's not like that. Every human being living this world may have done a lot of good things and a lot of maybe bad things too, unfortunately. Now, for bad things, perhaps you may have to suffer. But for the good things also, you will be rewarded. So, according to the fruition of these deeds done in this world, you will be reborn again. So Nachiketa puts a question before Yama. What is the truth behind this? According to some people, death is the end of the journey. According to some other philosophers, it is not the end of the journey. There is something which continues to exist. Atman, Brahman, self, consciousness, whatever you may call it, it continues to exist. Body perishes at the time of death. But there is an imperishable reality within the body which continues to live, which is reborn again, which transmigrates from body to body until it gets liberation. So please teach me the mystery of death. This is the third question that this small boy asks. Now the point remember is, Upanishads are the only books in which this third boon is asked, this inquiry. Because the idea that there is something beyond even heaven is the speciality of Vedanta. Because, you know, heaven is after all our imaginary extension of happiness in this world. See, if you read any monotheistic book in popular Hindu mythology or in any Abrahamic religious, any book you read is stories of heaven. You get everything in heaven, whatever you get in this world. But you don't have to pay anything. You get completely free for any length of time you get. That's all. So Nachiketa asked to know the mystery behind the concept of heaven and hell. Is there something beyond even hell, heaven? Now, in answer to this, Yama, the Lord of Death, gives the reply. He says, this Atman, this Supreme Consciousness, it is the immanent reality living in all of us. It is In fact, the verse is this: Anoho aniyan mahato mahiyan atma sijantoho nikitam guhayam. Tamakradu pasyadi vita shokaha dhadu prasadan mahimanam atmana. This is a Sanskrit verse. This reality is the immanent truth in the smallest, minutest of the minute in this world. And it is also present in the grandest, largest of the large entities in this world. By practicing spiritual disciplines, contemplation, meditation, we can manifest this immanent reality. And that's the end of human life. So, the third boon which Nachiketa asked, actually, that is the line of demarcation between the Vedanta philosophy and non-Vedanta philosophy. Because in Vedanta philosophy, a third inquiry is made beyond heaven. Is there something eternal in this life? Am I just this psychophysical mechanism which does something wrong and something right and gets punished for doing something wrong and gets rewarded for doing everything all right? Or is there something else beyond all this? Something beyond death, beyond heaven? So, elaborating this answer, Yama explains the spiritual essence of human existence. So, the whole human life is compared to a journey in a chariot. Okay, this is Atmanam Ridhidam Vidhi, means the owner of the chariot is Atman. The driver is intellect. The horses are our senses of action, senses of perception. Mind is the reins by which we control the horses. Now, if with proper spiritual wisdom and intelligence, we control the senses with mind properly, we can reach our destination in this world. On the other hand, if we allow the senses to control the mind, then this journey may end in a precipice, or these horses, when they are not properly controlled, can take the passenger, or the charioteer, towards by lanes, high or narrow pathways, or maybe over the precipice. It can lead to his death and destruction also. So, all spiritual practices are meant to control these senses of action, senses of perception. So, mind should be able to control the senses of action and senses of perception. Just like rain should be able to control the horses. Then only the charioteer, the driver of the chariot, will be able to control the horses and reach his destination. Otherwise, what happens, you know, the horses will drag the chariot in their own direction and the journey will end in a tragedy. So, the teacher ultimately tells Nachiketa, a proper discerning spiritual seeker should be able to control his senses properly, should try to combine contemplation and action in this world, in life, so that he will be able to lead a proper spiritual life. His mind will not be dictated by the senses. The senses will be under the control of the mind. That will make his journey of life fruitful. Now we will have an interaction. You can ask any of these, any questions related to the subject I've been dealing with. We have a little more time. If we started a bit late, you can ask any doubts from any.
Yes, I wanted to talk about hellfire. Because, the widespread notion is if you've gotten off the path and you're in the wreck, you're going to burn forever. I mean, that's a widespread notion. But when we think of the concept of these seeds or tendencies being burned up, once the actual fuel is consumed, there can be no more fire. So I'm thinking that this is a fundamentally different concept about what happens with tendencies that are carried forward, with bad tendencies, let's say. The one is the fire goes on indefinitely. The other is fire consumes the tendencies, and then there's nothing more for them to consume. Does this kind of fit in with what we're talking about?
When the hellfire has got the status of an ontological reality in monotheistic religious tradition, just as life is just one journey, at the end of the journey, you are going to heaven or you're going to hell. So hellfire gets the status, the ontological status of a reality. In Vedanta, you find in Vedantic tradition, you find you may have to suffer the consequences of some of the undesirable deeds that you may have performed in this life. But that doesn't mean that you are bound once for all. You have always a chance to come back and enjoy the fruits of the good deeds that you have done. So the minutest meritorious deed will have its positive fruit in our life. So there are a number of stories are mentioned in these books. See, people who have done some good deeds in their early days, but later had a deviation, but then suddenly they remember their good deeds to the end of their life. So if that remembrance leads to repentance, then they are completely purged of the effects of the evil deeds. Such examples are there. So a few I have already mentioned. The story of an old man who was about to die. His son's name was the same word which is used to call God in monotheistic Hinduism, the name of Vishnu. So he was not calling the name of God, he was calling his son. Son came, but this man, when he was a small child, he was a spiritual seeker. He had done a lot of spiritual practices, meditation, taking the sacred name. So, and he was chanting the same holy name, which was given to his own son. So, when he was about to die, he was not thinking of God. He was not taking the name of God. He was actually calling his son to his side. But when the son came, suddenly in his helpless mental state, his mind went back to his childhood days. And suddenly the memory of meditating or chanting the sacred name of God came to him. And that led to his repentance and he was liberated. So stories are there. So the idea is this. It's not a kind of license for us to do bad things. But the idea is this, one can start a spiritual life any day, any time. We need not think that a heavy burden, like a heavy stone, is always tied around our neck. Some unfortunate things we people have done. So they should always live in a fear of eternal damnation. That is not accepted in Vedantic tradition. That's the idea behind it. So it gives hope, encouragement for any spiritual seeker to start a new life anytime. That's the idea behind
You mentioned Maya in the context. I can't exactly express it, but in a previous session, you spoke of the fact that we cannot stop thoughts, that we have to redirect thoughts. So basically, when we speak of mind control in Vedanta, we're really speaking of directing our thoughts to a spiritual goal rather than to some sensory goal.
Yes, yes. True.
So that is, so mind is a bundle of thoughts, or
yes, yes.
And we have to direct,
yes.
The only way to control is direct our thoughts to,
yes,
for spiritual,
yeah,
ideas.
To direct it towards spiritual channels. Because mind has accumulated all kinds of thoughts. Some of them are very good, some of them are not so very good. So the only way to counter negative thoughts is to strengthen the accumulation of positive thoughts. Because, you know, in Vedanta, as you said, you know, mind control as such only means going beyond mind. And you go beyond mind when the mind is completely free of all negative thoughts. When it is enriched, reinforced with strong positive thoughts, then you can go beyond mind. That's the idea. And another aspect I can, of course, this may be of academic interest. Many of you may remember, you know, Plato's concept of philosopher king. Is a, according to Plato, philosophy is a vision of truth. And for him, you know, entire universe is interconnected, not mechanically, in a teleological sense. There's a grand, great purpose designed behind entire natural phenomena. So there are some fundamental universal truths. Of course, he believed in plurality, not in one supreme reality, of course. And so he said that a ruler should be a philosopher. A philosopher may not become a ruler, because philosophy is not so popular, he says. So, but the ruler can become a philosopher. So by which he meant a synthesis of action, which is natural to a ruler, with the contemplation and higher thinking, which is natural to a philosopher. This idea is found in the Gita in a graphic style. There is a long description of this. In fact, that is the very essence of yoga, according to Gita. In the fourth chapter, it is stated here. Krishna says, that an ideal yogi should combine in his character the dynamism and efficiency of an administrator, and the saintliness and the calm tranquility of a philosopher. In fact, that is the essence of philosophy of yoga. If we can combine action with contemplation, action is natural. But very often, you know, we act out of a strong motive, and normally our mind may be dragged by the five senses. Now, how do we regulate the movement of the senses towards the sense objects? By recognizing, by remembering in mind the limitation of all that senses can bring to us. Senses can never bring, sensory pleasures can never bring eternal happiness. So we can live in this world, but we need not necessarily become worldly minded. That's the idea behind here. So if one can remember the limitation or the perishable nature, the non-eternal nature of sensory pleasures, then sensory pleasures will not dominate our life. We will not be, under the tyranny of our senses. Senses will be regulated and controlled by the mind. Then what happens? Then a person can combine in his character the calm tranquility, the saintliness of a sage, and the efficiency of an administrator. That's the idea behind Rajarshi, it's called. So the word Rajatva means it corresponds to material pleasure, material prosperity, empirical achievement, and all that. But Rishi is the Sanskrit term for sage, you know. And sage is a person who lives in this world, who may make use of all that the world can offer, but he calmly understands, all these worldly pleasures are perishable, they cannot bring eternal peace. He will not run away from the world. He can live in this world, but while living in this world, he will not forget that worldly pleasures are not eternal. It is this recognition that makes him a saint or a sage. So sageliness or saintliness of a philosopher and the dynamism of a ruler. This is the ideal of yoga. In fact, this synthesis is the essence of yoga philosophy, according to tradition.
Our foghorns. You hear them sometimes?
Excuse me?
Foghorns.
He didn't say that.
He doesn't know.
No?
I don't know.
Foghorns.
Oh, out there in the bay.
Oh, that's oh.
Is that oh?
Yes, in fact. It's.
Cultured people, the Aryans, in the old sense of the word, that they were the ones seeking higher knowledge and insight. And today we have the parable of the son, who had apparently initially not been on the right path to be cultured in this way.
Son?
The son relative to the father.
Oh, yes, yes, right, right. Yes, right, yes.
The disciple.
That's right.
So, given that it's good to have spiritual inquiry, these inquiries occur through the senses, the five senses.
Yes.
The philosophy shows us that the senses are also unreliable.
Yes.
So how are we to know when we're on the path of good inquiry?
Yes. So I can give this the first, let us say the first question. The son asked a question, you know, when the father told him that every day in deep sleep, without our being aware of it, we transcend the duality, we transcend the plane of miseries and unhappiness, we become one with that supreme reality without our being aware of it. And then the son asked the question, then why is that we are not aware of it at all? So the answer is, the bees that go about collecting honeys from different flowers, when the honey is formed, the separate identities are completely merged. Only single honey exists. Now here you find the illustration is from sensory life, from empirical life. Spiritual truths can never become part of illustrations. We have to make use of illustrations from this world. So the son, the father is coming down to the level of the son, who will understand if a great spiritual truth or philosophical truth is explained, in the light of this illustration. Say 6,000, 7,000 years back, they were living mostly in forest regions. You know, the saints, sages used to live in forest hermitages. Again, look at the other illustration. The father asked the boy, look at this tree. The illustration in Sanskrit, Jivan Mahavriksha Drishtandha, means the illustration of the tree, the living tree, illustration of the great living tree. The father is pointing at the big tree standing right in front of the hermitage, which the son knows perfectly well. Now, making use of this illustration, the father takes the boy to a higher spiritual, philosophical truth. And again, look at the illustration of the river. All these rivers, when they merge in the ocean, they lose their independent identities. When the water gets merged with the ocean, there is only one reality. But in fact, this water becomes vapor because of sunlight, and they become clouds, and they pour down as rains and fill the same rivers. So the rivers do not recognize that it's the same ocean water which took the form of vapor and cloud, which are coming back as water, filling the rivers. The rivers are not aware of it. So this rotation you can find. So all these illustrations are taken from valleys, mountains, forests, trees, oceans, rivers, and so on. So all these illustrations are from empirical life, from life, from our common life, common sense life situations. But then these illustrations act as a bridge through which this boy is connected to the higher spiritual truth. But again, there is one point to remember. After every instruction, the boy is asked to meditate for a long time, for several days. After several days of meditation, he comes back to the father, the teacher, and asks for another explanation. So that, of course, that is a story. I mean, that is the background of the story. After every illustration, the boy is asked to meditate. That Shankaracharya, the great commentator, has explained in that light. The text doesn't say that the boy was asked to meditate. But the great commentator says, after every illustration, the father asks, now you go and meditate. And after meditating for some days, he comes back again to the father. This is my doubt, please explain once more. So 9 times this instruction is repeated. It's clear to you?
Yes.
Right, thank you.
So, usually when we talk about liberation or salvation, usually talked about the souls of humans, right? I was just wondering if there's anything in the scripture to talk about like souls of animals. Like, the souls of animals go through the same circle.
Could you, excuse me, you know, it's a bit difficult to hear from this distance. Could you come closer? We can, please come. Please, now. It seems to be a very interesting question, so we can have an actual discussion.
So
please.
When we talk about liberation or salvation,
yes.
We usually talk about souls of human beings, right? So I'm just wondering what happens to souls of animals.
Yes.
Do they go through the same circle? Like, is liberation or salvation something that's even possible for them?
Yes. Yes. Now, according to Vedanta, the difference between animals, human beings, and the highly evolved human beings, the difference is one of degrees, not of kind. The Atman or the soul, the consciousness, is present in all beings, including the animals. Now, it's like, see, the sun may be reflected in 1,000 mirrors. Depending upon the quality of the mirror, whether it's dirty, clean, or dusty, according to the quality of the mirror, the reflection can vary. effulgence of the reflection will vary. So in a highly evolved spiritual person, this Atman manifests in greater effulgence. But in primitive, unevolved beings at a lower level. So gradually the entire creation will become one with the Supreme Reality. This evolution is a continuous process, continuing and continuous process. That's the idea behind. I can just quote to you one statement from Swami Vivekananda. He says in this context, the difference between an amoeba and a Buddha is one of degrees, not of kind. Buddha in Sanskrit means the enlightened one. Need not necessarily mean the great Gautama Buddha. Buddha is the Sanskrit term for the enlightened, the spiritually evolved person. So what's the difference between a great spiritual person and an amoeba? Not one of kind, but one of degrees. In amoeba, this consciousness is manifesting at a very, very low degree. In a highly evolved person, it is manifesting in a much higher degree. That's the idea behind. Okay? Thank you, thank you. Sorry, because I can't hear from that distance. Yes. Right. So shall we stop? It's already 9 o'clock. Om, peace, peace, peace. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Hari Om, Tat Sat, Sri Ramakrishna.